to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you all over the world and all the other stations listening in, those listening over the telephone. So something that maybe we can learn from. The Italian court rules stealing food is not a crime if you're poor and hungry. And also today, since I've completed interviewing more than 3,000 homeless individuals, 10 lessons about what it's really like to be homeless in America. Also sharing some insights from Evelyn Knives from Alternet. But we also want to share some audio clips with you, and I'll tell you about those clips a little later on. So let's begin. Well, first up, some new information about the movement to label genetically engineered materials. Good for Vermont, it's now law in the state, but now the federal government is backing a new law which would completely remove all state laws. And we knew they were going to try this. Let me share the latest from the Organic Consumers Association. Quote from Organic Bites, "It's hard to know which is worse, the corporations that profit from poisoning your food and water, or the politicians who will happily sell you down the river for a few campaign contributions. Today, our leaders in the U.S. Senate proudly announced that they have reached a deal on a federal GMO labeling bill. No matter how they spin it, and they will spin it, this compromise is nothing more than a handout to Monsanto, an industry brokered deal intended to legally sanction the right of corporations to deceive you, the consumer. Today, the U.S. Senate unveiled a bill that, if passed, will overturn Vermont's mandatory GMO labeling law and replace it with an anti-consumer bill that allows food corporations to hide, that's right, to hide GMOs behind the barcodes and toll-free numbers, and gives them another 2 years before they even have to pretend they're labeling. So what does this news mean for Vermont's mandatory labeling law? Vermont's law will still take effect July 1st, because Congress has run out of time to get the bill passed by both House and Senate and plop it down for Obama's immediate signature. He'll probably do a dash, and because it's a corporation he can later on get funds from, and we all know how that plays. If we thought the Clintons made a bundle, $123 million, it is nothing compared to what Obama's are going to make. But once Congress returns after July 4th recess, you can bet your life that Monsanto's minions in Congress will make it their highest priority to seal the deal on an industry-friendly, anti-consumer, anti-state rights federal law that will overturn Vermont's law and leave U.S. consumers in the dark. And so that's how they're doing it. One more reason that coming this fall, many of us are joining together in a coalition to work with the state's committees to try to get a constitutional Congress so that we can overturn Citizens United, that we can overturn gas hydrofracking and oil exploration in different states, so we can overturn environmental laws that were friendly to corporations but against the consumer, where we're drinking polluted water and over 40 million Americans each day do not have clean water, so we can bring back the rights of the community. So we need a constitutional convention. We need to understand how absolutely corrupt on every level, in every way, our government has become. We need government, but we need government accountable to the people, protecting the environment, protecting our health, protecting our rights. Our current government is the most corrupt government in American history. Our government now views you as an enemy of the state if you protest. You're supposed to be an obedient consumer. You're supposed to fill your mind with absolutely worthless material and just buy what they tell you. take the meds they tell you, honor your doctors they tell you, and not to question. If you do, you're on an enemies list. Is that the government that we want? So we have to take back our country from the liberal, corrupt, democratic processes that are completely, totally, 100% in their pocket. The Republican conservative processes, 100% in their pocket. The demagogues they have on MSNBC and Mother Jones and these other publications, we have to start over and look for the truth in all things, and we can only do that with constitutional convention. The state should have the rights, and then we, the people, at the state level, can throw out any politician that has met with and passed bills on behalf of ALEC or any lobbyist. Have to clean it up. Will it take time? Probably 10 to 20 years. Can it be done? Yes. What is the option except to live in a dystopian society? So that's one of the consequences of people not having the power at the state or even the local level. So if you in a state want to have no pesticides, no glyphosate sprayed, you don't have the right. If the federal government wants it sprayed, it'll be sprayed because the federal government usurps all local and state laws. We have a lot of involvement with our children today, and I think it's important to understand what this Journal of Child and Family Studies has to say. This was a Florida State University study. Here's what it says, quote, as thousands of young adults prepare to leave the nest and attend college for the first time, parents may want to examine whether they are kind and supportive or hovering into helicopter parent territory. Parental involvement is crucial to a child's development and into an adult. But Florida State University researchers are finding that crossing the line between supportive and too involved could indirectly lead to issues such as depression and anxiety for young adults. Quote, helicopter parents are parents who are overly involved. That's according to Dr. Reed. They mean everything with good intentions, but it often goes beyond supportive to intervening in the decisions of emerging adults. And these helicopter parents can have a very terrible impact upon their children. So the kid doesn't know how to handle adverse situations in life. And this is what they found. And so here are my thoughts on this. I'm finding it more and more concerning that some students in colleges don't want to have a discussion on issues that are important because it makes them feel uncomfortable. So how they feel about an issue, how they feel about an instructor or professor teaching a subject is more important to them than whether they may learn something and develop some critical skills at coping with life. They're in an environment that is protective. For most of their upbringing, they have lived in fairly protected environments, depending upon their background and social and economic and cultural considerations. But when they get into an educational environment, if you have a highly orthodox educational environment whose principal reason for being is A, to make a profit, B, to be able to condition young minds into believing in a particular ideology, and that's happening, but above and beyond all else, to make you feel good and to keep anything that might challenge that out, well, then we will have been graduating the most ill-prepared generation in American history. Because once you get into the real world, where you don't have the right to boycott a class because a professor wanted to talk about something in on a topic you didn't want to hear about, and this is the power of students today. They can actually, between they and the mess that many of the PTAs do, where the parents want to rule, what do you mean my child is not learning? I'll have your job. You have no idea, unless you're a teacher, what it's like to be a good teacher today, a bad teacher today, try to change the curriculum in a meaningful way, try to help students prepare for life instead of taking a test, how to deal with obstreperous, contentious, vulgar, and mean-spirited parents who don't give a damn about their kid. They just want to make sure that their kid gets through and that you're not supposed to judge them. And if the kid didn't do homework or it's not smart, you're not supposed to give them an F. You're supposed to give them an A. And so I'm just appalled. I'm utterly appalled at our entire educational system. It is such a failure on every level. Now, for those older generation who want to give some input, you should. So here's my question of the day. This is not just for teachers, active or retired, or principals, educators, but for any parent that sees what happens when you put too much of your needs into the developing child, hence the helicopter parent. And it's not just about a parent who's rich enough to afford 60,000 lessons a month that a CAD must take in order to prove something to the parent, in which case the child's going to be hyper-exhausted adrenals, overstimulated, and feeling that they have no rights of their own because the moment they decide to do something, there's someone barking at them to win at all costs, do better, get the A's. And so they may succeed. You tutor a kid, you give them special teaching, you pamper them, and they'll do what you want until they meet other kids and see what damage you've done, and then they're going to hate you for it. So if a lot of parents are wondering what went wrong, well, how about maybe you should have thought twice about your kid was just an extension of your unrequited needs. So I think we have the worst group of parents in American history. Cupcake kids. They're going to fail. They're going to fail in their relationships because they don't know how to have one. They're going to fail in the world because they're not prepared for it. They're going to fail in life because they're going to personalize everything. And when you're in the real world, you can't say, I don't want to see that. You mean there's a war someplace? You mean there's I don't want to see poor people. I don't want to see, I don't want to see a mangy dog. I don't want to see a cow being killed. I just want the hamburger. I don't want to see, refugees. I don't want to know there's bombs dropping. I don't want to know any of this stuff. Well, go live in, Beverly Hills then, or go live in Silicon Valley where there's nothing but delusion. But what about the real world? Are you going to be a part of it? I haven't seen it yet. You're going to actually step up? Well, that means you have to have an awareness of what to step up to. So I'm concerned that for those of you who thought you're going to be able to retire, take it easy, turn everything over to the next generation, better think twice about what you're likely to get if you turn it over. In fact, just saw a video this morning. I'm going to play a short segment of it. This video, I'll play it in a few minutes. This video was of a person asking all blacks at a Hillary Clinton conference about, do they actually know what she did to blacks? And he asked a legitimate question. He asked it in a little comedic way, but he says, why do any blacks support? Well, of course, you'd know why Reverend Jackson and some of the others would. Yes, they're corporate blacks. But for the blacks that haven't sold out, why in the hell would you support one of the most tyrannical, vile human beings in American history of what they've done to blacks? All right, it boggles my mind. And yet they go over to a group of all white, Bernie Sanders supporters who said, you shouldn't support Clinton because of her treatment of blacks. Where's the disconnect here? So is that generation going to run the country? Wow. Shouldn't we pay attention to these issues? You're not going to hear these issues on NBC or the worst for the brain. I think that if you listen to NPR too long, you actually atrophy the brain. 1 hour of atrophy of the brain for every 5 minutes of listening to it. It's Wonder Bread for the brain. So the media's not going to touch these issues because it's been bought and sold. So how are we going to, A, help the kids actually learn about life, engage in it, learn critical thinking, engage in social issues, and be a constructive part? There are a small group who are, and thank goodness that their parents helped them do that. But what about the vast, vast 95% majority? What is the solution? I have my ideas. I'd like yours. 888-874-4888. because this study showed that you overprotect your kid, you overpraise your kid, you try to buffer everything from the kid, then you demand certain things from the kid because you want them to overachieve, you're going to end up with a depressed or anxious-filled kid that's going to just be a mess. And then when they start taking the medications, if they're not already, and you get them on dexedrine-type drugs every day, and then you wonder why they one day kill themselves or go on a rampage or why they're hanging on the roof, now you know. A whole lot of people, it took a whole village to kill a kid. It took the psychiatrist who didn't, it's not a legitimate science. It's a fool's, bunch of fools. Unless they're using psychotherapy, then it is legitimate. You take a whole field of psychologists who want to be psychiatrists, and they're saying, yeah, ADD and ADHD is real. It takes the school teacher who says, Jimmy was looking out the window. Jimmy needs a drug. Jimmy has got to pay attention. I want all my kids this class to pay attention. I don't care if they learn anything, as long as they get an A. But don't worry about that. We've dumbed down the test, and then we allow them to cheat so everybody wins, and we all get happy days. It takes the parents. It takes a whole village to destroy a kid. How's that for a reverse notion? So what are we going to do about it? Anything? Nothing? There's going to be consequences. I'd like your input. Now, separately, Washington University says that the older the drinking age, the lower the illness rates. I would agree with that. But keep in mind, when kids are drinking younger today, and it's a part of their the way they socially network, and especially in high school and college, you're ending up with a high level today of liver disease, heart disease, inflammatory disease like arthritis, and diabetes. So shouldn't we not just think about the age that someone starts drinking, but shouldn't we have a class in every school in America talking about that which destroys the body's cells and how it does, and that which protects the body's cells? How does it work? Showing, for example, a film. Here's apple juice, orange juice, grape juice. Here's whiskey, whether it's vodka or gin or bourbon, and here's beer. And here's wine. Here's what they do inside your body. And then show them cells. Show them a million. In fact, I was halfway doing this last year, and I had to finish my other documentary, so I was only halfway finished. But I had the opening scene where little faces, with fear in their eyes and tight little bodies, and they were cells. And then there were 1 million cells. And behind them was a person shooting them in the head, just like, you know, the Chinese shot millions of people in the head and during their purges, and others as well. And you actually see a cell being destroyed. So you're killing yourself. That's real. That's not imaginary. You kill a million brain cells, a million heart cells, a million liver cells, a million kidney cells with every single drink you take of a hard alcohol. Every single drink. So when your kid one day is 27 years old and already they have atrophy of the brain and they have disease of the liver and they now have heart problems, they've got occlusion in their arteries, you think, how did this happen? Well, because no one informed them of the risks. So I'm going to finish that film. It's going to be a short, like a 60-second spot to show you there's a consequence. Now show them what happens when they drink the apple juice, the orange juice, the green juice, and you actually repair the cell. You have a happy cell, dead cell, living cell, damaged cell, healing cell. And we don't even have this basic information being given to people today. So they go out, hey, let's go binge drinking. Hey, let's do this. Hey, let's... There's a consequence. Did anyone really talk with you about that? No. Well, we should have that conversation with every kid in America, because otherwise we're looking at an epidemic of diseases in kids. Now, for those of you who've had problems with your digestion, there's a lot you can do. I'm going to give you one additional thing today, just one. L-glutamine. Gluta, G-L-U-A-T, amine, which is amino acid, A-M-I-N-E, glutamine. And what glutamine does in hundreds of peer-reviewed studies, it helps your gastrointestinal tract. It helps prevent stomach cancer, which, by the way, is the fifth most commonly diagnosed cancer. A whole lot of people get it, generally because they have Helicobacter pylori, the bacteria that can create it, and also Epstein-Barr virus has been linked substantially to causing stomach cancer as well. So when you have these stomach ulcers that then evolve into inflammatory conditions, and you're drinking coffee, which then really exacerbates that and causes massive inflammation in the stomach, and then you're taking in meat or other things that further that inflammatory process, then you end up one day with stomach cancer. But glutamine comes in, and it helps to protect the cells, especially when you've had so much ammonia. Because ammonia, which is a byproduct of animal protein, and it happens after every single meal with you, when you have any kind of animal protein, you get a high gastric reaction. And L-glutamine, which is amino acid, it detoxifies ammonia in the stomach. And it does the same thing in your liver. As a result, it reduces the opportunity for cancer. Now, where do you get your glutamine? Well, you can take glutamine like 2,000-3,000 milligrams in a capsule form, but you can also get it if you have salmon. You get it from salmon or cod. You can get it, however, from beans and spirulina and cabbage and spinach and Brussels sprouts and kale and broccoli. You can get it from papaya. You can get it from fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut and pickles and miso. You can get it from carrots, beets, asparagus, and celery. You can get it from walnuts, almonds, pistachios, and that's the best places to get it. And it really helps the immune system of your gastrointestinal system. And finally, stay productive while at work. This is a Harvard University Medical School study, and what it shows is that people are taking, let's say, caffeine in mid-morning when they start to see their energy drop, and mid-afternoon. And throughout the day, their energy goes up and then comes down. And the reason it comes down is because what you consume. If you consume anything that breaks down into a simple carbohydrate, like a sandwich, a pasta, donut, a roll, a bagel, which are common, then you're going to have this roller coaster, and that's not good. So what we need to do is we need to have foods that sustain your blood sugar. For example, start your day with a good quality breakfast, meaning about 15 to 20 grams of high quality plant-based protein, about 15 to 20 grams of high quality fiber. Throw in some nuts, throw in some berries, and now you have a full measure of all the nutrients you need to get your body in high gear, and it'll sustain for about 4 to 5 hours. Then have something that's a grazing food. Like if you took an avocado to work with you and you made a little dressing, you poured the dressing on it and had that avocado, that'll sustain you for the next 3 hours. Or if you took some hummus or baba ganoush, that will sustain you. If you had an apple, that would sustain you. If you had a handful of nuts, that will sustain you. Stay away from the coffee. Stay away from the sweets. And this way you stay productive at work all day long. Your energy is even all day long, because whenever your blood sugar goes down and you suffer from hypoglycemia, you're less attentive, you're more likely to make errors, and you go into that, you know, kind of no-space zone. So that's important. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. But before we take a break, here's a question. And I did this about 2 weeks ago. I'm going to ask again. Why do so many blacks in America support a couple that was so destructive to people of color? And I mean really destructive. Took away millions of people's welfare rights, which was the only source of food and support that they had. Made it tough on prisoners when you get out of jail. You've done your time. You've served your sentence almost always longer than what it should have been. But you've served your time. Now you're coming back in society, and hopefully you understand how to become a productive member of society, and then they punish you again. Well, you can't live in this complex. You can't get public assistance. You can't get food stamps. what am I supposed to do? I already got this record that no one wants to hire me because I'm an ex-felon. How can I support myself? And no one gets it, that maybe this was the wrong approach. Maybe we should have centers where people come out and then are re-educated to help them learn new skills or learn to be a part of the current society and help them in that segue. I think it's much better helping people segue from a prison or incarceration back into society than just to throw them on the street and say, make do. Easy to say when you're a millionaire, not so realistic when you're coming out. And they put an awful lot of them in. Listen up to this.
Here in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Democratic presidential primary debate to find out, why do black people still like Hillary Clinton?
When I say Hillary, you say Clinton. Hillary
Clinton!
I've been reading this book, The New Jim Crow, and it's got some gnarly stuff about Hillary Clinton. It says when her husband was president, she lobbied Congress to increase the drug war and mass incarceration. And the best-selling author of the book, civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander, says Bill Clinton's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increase in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. But Clinton was not satisfied with exploding prison populations. He and the New Democrats championed legislation banning drug felons from public housing and denying them basic public benefits, including food stamps for life. Discrimination in virtually every aspect of political, economic, and social life is now perfectly legal if you've been labeled a felon. What do you think about that, 1994 Hillary Clinton?
It's a very well thought out crime bill that is both smart and tough.
Awkward.
What book is it?
It's called New Jim Crow, New York Times bestseller. It's called During Bill Clinton's Tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, boosted corrections by $19 billion, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor. I'm just trying to get confirmation.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm the chair of the DNC.
Yeah, Debbie. Why should you know? You're only the chair of the Democratic National Committee. Hey, black people, help me out.
Would you say that you've been able to forgive her and her husband for tough-on-crime policies that led to mass incarceration?
I can't talk to New York.
I can't answer that right now because I want to cheer for Hillary.
Can I ask any questions?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you.
You're good?
Can't talk to the press, sorry.
Why not?
Just don't want to answer the question.
But it is part of, like, history and reality, right?
Right.
I'm trying to find out why black people still like the Clintons. Oh, man. Not even the South Carolina head of communications for Bernie Sanders' campaign will talk shit about Hillary. During Bill Clinton's tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, boosted corrections by $19 billion, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor, and Hillary championed these policies and lobbied Congress for them. Can you please speak to that?
So what I will say is there has not been another poll in South Carolina for a little bit of a while, but we feel the momentum and our ground game is on our side and that we are feeling things shift.
Wow, Simone, that was a great answer. It just happened to be to a completely different question from the one I asked you.
One out of three African-American men may well end up going to prison. That's the statistic. I want people here to think what we would be doing if it was one out of three white men.
It's a very well thought out crime bill that is both smart and tough.
Awkward.
Okay, there you have it. And no one is talking about this. Bernie Sanders didn't bring this up in the debates. It should have been brought up. You've caused millions and millions of human beings of color to be incarcerated. Think of what that did to the kids. Think of what it did to the ones left behind, to the fathers and the mothers of those people. And how often were they sent to prison for just marijuana crimes, which shouldn't be a crime in any civil society where people actually had some sense of spiritual connection and common sense. They would decriminalize all drugs, but not here. And the Democrats and Republicans were equal in this, but the Clintons were the architects of that. Tens of millions of people have been adversely affected, but the prison system, which is one of the largest contributors to campaign Clinton, they don't have a problem with it. They want people in those jails, preferably people of color. Well, that's the issue. I'd like your feedback now. 888-874-4888. That and our children and the cupcake generation and how we are, well, we're just abrogating the responsibility to teach people what they need to know in order to be critical thinkers, look at life honestly, find solutions, and become more proactive. That we're not doing. What's our solution? Your turn. We're going to take a break and come back, and we'll see what you have to say about this. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We do take on the important social issues, and we will not compromise on the significance of these. Now, I'm going to be flying blind now because I have no names, where you're at. I wished I did. At least I could acknowledge your name and where you're at because we're having a little computer glitch because we're turning on some brand new systems today. But we're just going to go down the list, and I'm going to ask our engineer, we're going to start with number one, the 914 number, and let's go down. Please give your name. You're on there. Hi, Stephen. Your thoughts, please.
I just wanted to add that a UN official was recently found mysteriously dead who was set to testify against Hillary Clinton the day before. They ruled it as a heart attack, but it later turned out that a barbell fell on his neck. John Ash, a UN black official, one day before he was set to testify against her. Something. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
I'm aware of it. Are you aware of how many people who were originally involved in the drug deals down in Mena, Arkansas, including high-ranking members of the state police, private investigators,
yes,
have died, yes, including jumping off buildings, being shot in the head, being shot in the back, the kids on the railroad tracks, so that it was later found that they had they'd been killed?
Yep, I know.
The media will
absolutely
not touch this. They're cowards.
No. Yep,
they're absolute,
that's right,
cowards. Did you hear about the people, the state troopers who went forward and talked about having delivered packages filled with cash to Bill Clinton?
I didn't know about that, but I read years ago of about at least 80 to 90 mysterious deaths surrounding the Clinton administration. Like you said, state troopers who were talking about how their wives ended up dead, reported as a suicide, and the husband started saying there's no way she'd kill herself, and then he ended up dead. Which is really, really bizarre. So
we do not have, I'm a little different on this. I don't deal in gossip or hearsay, so I hired a top Army intelligence expert to go down to Mena, Arkansas, spend time down there, and see about the drugs. First, he was able to report that, yes, multiple planes were coming in. They were changing the numbers on the planes, and they were unloading materials. And, of course, what goes back on the planes are guns. And these were shipped back to the Nicaraguans, who were then the Sandinistas. and called our freedom fighters, equated, unfortunately, to our founding fathers. No, these were people who were the thugs, the murderers of Somoza's National Guard that we supported and disrupted their entire ecology, economy, and their country. And that was coming out of Mena, Arkansas. And there were a whole lot more. By the way, why don't you ask the media to invite on the woman who's a lawyer, very respected in her field, who had a 10-year affair with Bill Clinton, where he bragged about 3,000 conquests, and get a different perspective. Because if this is the person that you're going to have as the co-presidency, and they represent the most important person we could put in power, shouldn't we know what their moral level is? I do. If it's a personal situation, whatever he does, his business, none of mine. But when he's going to be speaking on behalf of all of us, no. I think it's just deplorable that we've never in our country's history elevated someone who had spiritual values to the highest office. That's just unfortunate. Angel from New York, your turn.
Yeah, hi, Gary.
Hi.
I had a comment about the felons getting jobs. I'm a nonviolent felon. It was pretty tough for me to get a job once I got out. But most recently, they changed the law where employers can't ask you if you're a felon before they offer you the job. And my family member of mine didn't have that on a question on an application. Went through the interview, was offered the job. Then after being offered the job, it was at a bank, and it was a media department in the bank. It had nothing to do with money. But because the FDIC has a rule where you can't hire, if you're dealing with money, you can't hire felons. So after being offered the job, he was told that he wasn't able to get the job. Do you have any information on that or comment on that?
Well, it's just an extension of what was created when they wanted to show they were tough on crime, so they made it really tough on crime. And it's no different than all the other laws, where if you jaywalk, you can be arrested. If you walk against the light, you can be arrested. And They have made so many things that should never be a law to begin with. They've made it into laws. Why are they doing this? Go to ALEC, go to the American Legislative Exchange Council. Look at what they're doing at the state level, meeting in secret once or twice a year with your legislators who are compliant, generally at a resort. They give your legislator a bill. They coach the legislator in how to bring the bill forward. The bill never helps the American public or the state residents. It helps the corporation, one of 200 to 300 that are members of ALEC, get their way, generally with reduction of regulation. We're allowing them to do something that otherwise we would be against. Now, then when they want to fill in the private prison system, they now have private prison judges, private prison courts, private bails, probation officers. So let's just say that you're poor, which over 240 million Americans are. And you have 18 million children belonging to these poor, and you have 1.6 million who are homeless. And now, and have no place to live. And now you can't pay a bill. And so what do? They then start penalizing you by giving you compounded interest. There's actually a case where a woman who couldn't afford to pay a traffic parking ticket of $40 ended up having to pay $700 and was arrested and incarcerated. And they charged her every day she was in jail. They charged her when she had to see the judge, and they charged her when she had to see a probation officer. Now, that's on her record now. And her family all had to come together, and someone had to sell one of their cars just to get her out. We have made it a crime to be poor. And shame on us for doing that. Let me read this from Common Dreams. Quote, stealing food if you are hungry and poor is not a crime, Italy's highest appeals court ruled on Monday. Judges with the Supreme Court of Cassation overturned a theft conviction against a Ukrainian man who stole $4.50 of a sandwich from a supermarket in Genoa, and finding that he had taken the food, quote, in the face of imminent and essential need for nourishment. And he was sentenced at the time to 6 months in jail and fined $115. quote, the condition of the defendant and circumstances in which the merchandise theft took place prove that he took possession of a small amount of food in the face of the immediate essential need for nourishment, acting therefore in a state of need. The theft does not constitute a crime, end quote. Now imagine how many people go to bed hungry in the United States. Imagine what it takes for a person to get to a place where they're forced to make a decision, a moral decision. Do I steal something or do I allow my children to go hungry? And then if they're caught stealing just to feed their kid, we put them in jail, we give them a record, we increase the amount of a poor person having to pay what they didn't have to begin with. If they had any money, they would have bought something for their kids now or themselves. Now we're putting them a debt on that. What kind of judicial system, what kind of society sanctions that kind of inhumanity? You have enough money to spend $4 to $5 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan in worthless wars that hurt the local people, destroy their environment, cause displacement, as well as American casualties. And yet, you don't have money to create food banks, to have people have farms that grow specifically for these. You don't have the money after you have given the Pentagon and the Defense Department $1.6 trillion a year. You don't have enough money to put a 1 acre hydroponic in every single city in America so you can grow food for local citizens in local communities that would help them. What does that say about our priorities? I want to share this with you, because this is based upon my own firsthand experience. When I was told one day, I was at my home, and I got a call, and a person said, I interviewed someone who is a 28-year-old homeless vet, and he is homeless. He tries to work. He can't find work. When they find out he's a homeless vet, they don't want to hire him. But he's in a little tent city with a group of people. Do you want to film it? I said, sure. So I went over there, and it didn't take long for us to find in the woods to find the first tent. And the first tent was a tiny pup tent, the kind you would have as a kid. And this guy had half his body out and the other half in, and the half was in. It had a little netting zipped down, but the bottom part, his legs were just eaten with all those mosquitoes and everywhere. I saw a poisonous snake while walking within 100 feet of where he was, and you have spiders, you have all kinds of stuff in the Everglades, in any case, or in the woods. So this was in Florida. So I talked with him. And what was interesting, when he opened up his tent, I saw that he had two T-shirts neatly folded. He had some underwear neatly folded. He had a shirt neatly folded. And he had three cans of beans. And he said that's all he had. No running water, no sewage, nothing. And he'd gone to the VA, but they wouldn't help him because, and I said, but you got blood stains on your shirt there. Let me take a look. So he pulled up his T-shirt, and I saw he had stents. And I said, you had heart stents? Yeah, 2 weeks ago. I said, but look at the tissue. It's black. I said, you've got an infection here, and that can lead to septicemia. That could kill you. And he took out this crumpled piece of paper. I said, what's that? He said, that's a prescription for antibiotics, but I went to the VA and I can't get it filled. I don't have any money. I only have $4. I thought, wow. You served your country? Yes. How many tours? 3 tours. And now you're sick. Well, they said they couldn't help me because I couldn't prove that my heart condition came from combat, and they'll only cover you if it's you can prove combat, and then there's an 18-month waiting list. And needless to say, I helped him. He said, I'm not alone. Where are the others, I asked? He said, let me show you. So we walked a little further back into the woods, and there was poison ivy and poison oak everywhere. As a naturalist, I'm used to the woods. As a life scout, almost an eagle, but I became a scout master, so I couldn't finish up my eagle. You learn to live in the woods. You can live off the land. You know nature. And these guys didn't know poison ivy or poison sumac or poison oak from anything. And you could see they'd have rashes on their arm and blistering. And there was a group of another 20 tents, and then there were more. And I talked with them. And I spent a long time talking with each one each day. And they walked in the morning. When it's dark, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and they get up and they walk 3 miles to an employment agency where it's not an official agency, it's where they hire out day laborers. And they were the first ones there, but they were the last ones to be chosen. And the moment they put down that they were a homeless vet, nobody would hire them. So I said, well, don't tell them you're a homeless vet. You know, you need to work. You need to earn some income. And they get your ID and look at your driver's license. If you don't have a driver's license, you're not going to get hired. They put you this whole torture process of not allowing you to work. But we still go, and then we walk back. And then at noon, we walk over to this place called the Daily Bread, and which is not supported by the state, federal government, or any other. This guy has done an incredible job of trying to feed what at one time was 100 homeless people. Now it's like approaching 1,000. And he has some showers so you can take a shower there. And he gives a meal with whatever food he's been able to get. And then they walk back. But if you should stop on your way back in a veteran's park and you're a veteran, you'll be arrested because it's not for homeless veterans. And then the neighbors don't like you. You've committed no crime. You've not stolen anything. You've done nothing. You're just walking. But you'll be stopped. You'll be profiled. So one way you don't get profiled, I was told, is you ride a bike. But first you have to get a bike. And so there's a group of them that will fix up old broken bikes so other vets can have them. And how many of them are there? In just one area of Florida, there's 16,000 homeless vets. Well, I went ahead and produced a film. I promised them I'd try to help them, and I've done the best I can. I help the Daily Bread. I help the vets. But I see the legacy of being victimized by being poor and homeless and how few Americans want to help. And then there was just this video where they took a little girl, I'm guessing she's about 5 years old, and they make her look like she's poor. You know, they put makeup on her, dark circles and the hair, and scrunch up the hair and all. And nobody, not a single person an hour, stopped to help this girl. Then they took the same girl and dressed her up as she normally would be, and everybody stopped. Mind you, because she was alone. Oh, where's your mom? But when she was poor and without a mom or dad, nobody cared. What does that say? These are important signs of a society in decay, the moral fiber. And so when you don't see a problem, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. You can't see cancer until it's almost at the full stage, but it was processing by wrong decisions. I'm seeing lots of wrong decisions. So here's 10 things you should know about what it's really like to be homeless. My ideas, as well as Evelyn Knives of Alternet. First and foremost, understand that you do not lose being a human being because you are poor. And we forget that. I live in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. And this is supposed to be the bastion of more progressive and liberal thinkers. And yet at morning, if you go early enough, and I get up at 4, so I'm up very early and out, you'll see people lined up, depending upon the time of year and the weather. It can be a long line of people down by the river, and they're washing their armpits and their chest and their face, brushing their teeth, and then getting ready to try to find work. Why this early, I ask? Well, because the joggers and the bikers get offended seeing us homeless people here. They want to believe that near Riverside Drive Park and that beautiful runway, that there's just people like them, successful, educated people. And sure enough, it's the case. And they don't care. Many don't care. So you're still a human being, even if you're homeless, even if you're poor. Also, an awful lot of homeless people work. We get this idea that somehow you're drugged out or drunk and you're looking for some free handout. That's the message a lot of the conservative community would like to give you. Not true. The majority of homeless people actually work. It's just they don't make enough. If you're getting minimum wage and you're working two part-time jobs and it's still not enough, then what do? You put your kids in a shelter, you do what you can, you rent a Motel 6, whatever you can do. Also, not all homeless people are drug addicts or alcoholics or depressed or anxious. A lot of them are just trying to do the best they can every day with what circumstances they have in front of them. And homeless people are actually more afraid of you than you are them. Because when you're homeless and you're an African American or Latino, or you're from a South American country, and you have no support system, you're afraid of what people can say, what they can do to you, because you have nothing on your side. So they're afraid of people. And do you know what it's like to be homeless and in the middle of winter and you're cold, you're hungry? Homeless people, especially homeless women, it's extremely difficult. What if you're an older homeless woman where you have to ride the bus all night just to stay safe or warm? And so therefore, we should have a different look at what it means to be homeless or poor in the United States. And for those who've contributed to it, including the Clintons more than anyone else, Koch brothers be behind them, just remember, it's very easy to make a judgment on someone if you've never had to be in that person's life, in their shoes, and go through a day as they have to go through. One last quick one, Jay from Queens. Trying to get
I made it on the show in this short time. But Gary, your last comment about homelessness is excellent and great point. I'd like to say that as far as blacks and their support of Hillary, like most Americans or most supporters of the Democratic Party, low information voters amongst Republicans and the Democrats, well accepted. And then the corporate interest and those who are corporatist in the interest of supporting the party that's going to give them a new job, don't want to talk about the issues. As you said, as the survey asked the question, they averted the question, answering the question all the way. And so black Americans are amongst the majority of all Americans who are just low information voters, don't know enough to make better decisions. And then they're led by the corporate elite who tell them how to vote. And that's the sad commentary we are. And thank you for what you're doing. Yes, the Hillarys are skullduggery just as much as the Trumps are. And we're stuck with, and we're not really stuck, we're dealing with the lesser of two evil nonsense, which we need to stop playing the game.
But we also have Jill Stein. So there's a person there who supports decriminalization of all drugs, getting people out of prison, stopping this system from its excessive imperial overreach and its racist policies. So we don't have just the lesser of two evils. And let's get all of the churches, the black Latino churches, to start educating the parishioners to the truth about social justice and its legacy in the United States. Thank you very much, Jay from Queens. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more in our next program. Have a nice day.